I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
A few times over the past few years, science writer Rosemary Mosco has told me that a good topic for this podcast might be the Sparrow War. And the first couple of times she suggested this, I was like, Chairman Mao's thing? Because we talked about that on the show in an episode on the famine that was connected to Mao Zedong's Four Pests campaign, which involved trying to eradicate sparrows. This is not that. The one that Rosemary was suggesting was a dispute over the house sparrow, which at the time was often called the English sparrow, and the introduction of this bird into North America. So Rosemary is the author of A Pocket Guide to Pigeon Watching, Getting to Know the World's Most Misunderstood Bird, along with several other books. And she wrote an article about the house sparrow for Audubon Magazine in 2023 that was titled Meet the Little Brown Bird That Holds a Mirror Up to Humanity. And this is something that she came across while doing research for these things that she's written and just kept sort of prodding me about it. She is right. I do love a ridiculous feud, and this was ridiculous. So it took me a while to get to it, but thank you, Rosemary, for the suggestion.
A lot of people had very strong opinions about house sparrows in the late 19th century, which continues to be true today. But this feud was mainly between Elliot Cowes and Thomas Mayo Brewer. We're not going to try to do full biographies of these two men, but we did want to give a glimpse into who they were and what they did aside from fighting over sparrows.
Thomas Mayo Brewer was born in Boston, Massachusetts on November 21st, 1814. He was from a well-off New England family, and his grandfather, Colonel James Brewer, participated in the Boston Tea Party. Brewer went to Harvard Medical School, and after becoming a doctor, he spent some time with a medical practice in Boston's North End. But eventually, he left medicine, and he became an editor at the Boston Atlas, where, in the words of an obituary, he became a, quote, political writer of unusual ability.
He was also interested in birds and entomology, or the study of bird eggs. He started publishing on birds in 1837, and he developed a reputation for himself within the field. In 1874, he published a three-volume History of North American Birds, which was co-authored with Spencer F. Baird and Robert Ridgway. Brewer's The Water Birds of North America was also published, but posthumously.
Brewer also became a friend and colleague of John James Audubon. Audubon named at least two birds after Brewer, although one was a duck that turned out to be a mallard-gadwell hybrid and not a newly described duck species, and the other one was a blackbird that had already been described by someone else.
Brewer died on January 23rd, 1880, at his home in Boston at the age of 65. In addition to his work in journalism and ornithology, he had also served on the Boston School Board. He was survived by his wife, Sally R. Coffin, who he had married in 1849, as well as their daughter, Lucy Stone Brewer. Thomas and Sally had also had a son, Charles, who had died in childhood. During his lifetime, Brewer had built a collection of bird eggs that included almost 15,000 specimens from 3,000 different species, described as one of the largest such private collections in existence. He left this collection to the Museum of Comparative Zoology in Cambridge.
In the words of an obituary in the Bulletin of the Natal Ornithological Club, of which Brewer was a member, quote, "Socially, Dr. Brewer was greatly esteemed. His warm sympathy, his loyalty to friends, and to his convictions of truth and duty were marked traits in his character. Removed suddenly, and when there were apparently years of activity and leisure before him for research, his loss to science is not easily replaced."
But also, in the words of the Biographical Dictionary of American and Canadian Naturalists and Environmentalists, quote, "Brewer regarded the field of Massachusetts birds as his private domain and did not think highly of younger generation of ornithologists."
One of the younger generation of ornithologists was Elliot Ladd Cowes. He was born on September 9, 1842 in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and was also descended from early colonists. When he was still a child, his family moved to Washington, D.C., and that's where he lived for the rest of his life, except when he was stationed somewhere else as an army surgeon. He studied medicine at Columbian College, which is now George Washington University, earning an M.D. and a Ph.D.
Cowes' work on birds and his time in the Army both started while he was still in medical school. He published his first work on birds in 1861 at the age of 19, and he enlisted in the U.S. Army as a medical cadet a year later. He was recognized for his work in ornithology right away. That first monograph, which was on North American shorebirds, was described as something that would have reflected well on a scientist of much greater experience. Cowes also published on mammals and reptiles, producing at least 300 works over the span of about 20 years. In addition to all of that, he worked with the U.S. Northern Boundary Commission and the U.S. Geological and Geographical Survey of the Territories in the 1870s.
Cowes' major work on birds included Key to North American Birds, which first came out in 1872. His Checklist of North American Birds was published in 1873, and Field Ornithology came out in 1874. He also edited and published the journals and other writings of a number of explorers and travelers, including the history of the Lewis and Clark Expedition and the expeditions of Zebulon Montgomery Pike. In 1877, he was elected a member of the National Academy of Science and eventually became a member of most of the scientific societies in the U.S. and Europe.
For a time, Cowes was also deeply interested in spiritualism and theosophy. He wrote a number of works on these subjects, including, for example, two letters in The Nation on December 25, 1884, one on psychic research and the other on the feasibility of studying ghosts. The letter on ghosts discusses all the ways that ghosts can be studied using evidence gathered through a person's senses, including writing that ghosts, quote, "frequently, not usually, emit a perceptible odor, sometimes very strong, sometimes fragrant, sometimes the reverse, nearly always peculiar to themselves."
He was a friend of past podcast subject Madame Blavatsky and held offices in the Theosophical Society, including serving as president of its American Board of Control. But in 1890, the New York Sun published an expose titled Blavatsky Unveiled. This took the form of an interview with Cowes. I don't know what caused his sudden about-face here, but afterward, he was expelled from the society. Blavatsky filed suit against him and against the Sun, but then she died in 1891. After her death, the Sun retracted the expose, and this almost became its own episode. It could maybe one day, but I was eventually like, you gotta go back to the sparrows now.
Right. Madame Blavatsky had a lot of ups and downs with people, so I'm not entirely surprised. Elliot Cowes died at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland on December 25th, 1899, at the age of 57. That was following a pair of surgical procedures. He had been in a coma, but in the moments before his death, he reportedly regained consciousness, sat upright, and said, "Welcome, oh welcome, beloved death," before dying.
Cowes had been married twice, first to Jane Augusta McKinney in 1867. They had five children, three of whom survived childhood. Their marriage ended in divorce in 1886, and the announcement of the divorce that ran in the Washington, D.C. Evening Star describes Cowes not as a doctor or as a scientist, but as the noted theosophist. His second wife was Mary Emily Bates, who he married in 1887.
In the words of a biographical memoir of Cowes that was read before the National Academy of Sciences in 1909, quote, "As an antagonist, he was sometimes bitter and unforgiving." The only mention of sparrows in that piece is in the footnote to that sentence, which reads, quote, "An unfortunate illustration is his controversy with the late Dr. T.M. Brewer, of which Dr. Cowes himself said 20 years after the death of his opponent, the controversy had become between Dr. Brewer and myself a personal feud, with the usual accompaniments in the way of sweetness and light."
We'll get to what they were feuding about after a sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, if... No. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the 1850s, caterpillars were a problem in the eastern United States. different accounts name different caterpillars, but most of them are moth larvae that kind of dangle from their silk, and they were colloquially called things like dropworms or cankerworms. Rosemary Mosco's article on the house sparrow cites an inchworm called the elm spanworm. Other sources cite linden moth larvae, which are also inchworms.
During an outbreak, these caterpillars defoliate trees, drop onto people and surfaces, poop everywhere, and they just generally make a big mess. Most of the time, the damage from a caterpillar outbreak is unsightly, but healthy trees can typically survive a year or two of caterpillar defoliation. Usually, trees only die if there's also something else going on, like a drought or a disease, or if the caterpillars defoliate the same tree year after year after year.
Caterpillar outbreaks are usually cyclical. Typically, they eventually end on their own, but people often want to try to do something about them. And one proposed solution for the caterpillar problem in the mid-19th century was to import house sparrows, or Passer domesticus, from Europe. These are small, stocky birds in shades of buff, brown, gray, and black, with the males more brightly colored than the females. They're native to a lot of Europe and Asia, as well as northern Africa.
So to today's ear, introducing a non-native bird species with the hope of controlling caterpillars with them probably sounds like an obviously bad idea. This is Homer Simpson logic. We have talked on the show before about what happened when people tried to use kudzu, which is native to East Asia, for erosion control in the United States, and what happened when colonists brought rabbits from Europe to Australia because they wanted Australia to feel more like Britain. Kudzu was later nicknamed the vine that ate the South, and we discussed those rabbits in an episode about an attempt to fence off an entire portion of Australia just to contain them. There are actually three fences because the rabbits kept getting ahead of the fence builders.
But this sparrow importation idea was happening alongside the acclimatization movement, which developed primarily in the UK and France in the 1830s and 40s. This movement was connected to colonialism, and it was focused on introducing non-native species and acclimatizing them to their new homes, as well as reshaping the world through the introduction of these plants and animals. This was more intentional and systemic than most earlier efforts to try to introduce non-native plants and animals to other parts of the world. So things like the introduction of food crops from the Americas to Europe and vice versa starting in the late 15th century. There were more than 50 acclimatization societies around the world by 1900. And while the ones in the United States were established after the sparrows had already been introduced, the acclimatization movement was like part of the context for their introduction. This was all connected to how people were thinking about what it was okay to do with non-native plants and animals.
The first attempts to introduce house sparrows into North America were not successful. One of the earliest was in 1850 when the Brooklyn Institute in New York got 8 pairs of sparrows from England and kept them in cages over the winter. The birds did not thrive when they were released in the spring, but the birds fared a bit better in a second attempt 2 years later. The first really successful effort was likely in Portland, Maine in 1854.
Soon, other cities were discussing whether they should import house sparrows as well. Cities started buying hundreds or even thousands of sparrows, mostly from England or Germany, and then releasing them into their parks and other green spaces. A number of articles written more recently about the Sparrow War also describe immigrants to the United States as wanting to have familiar birds around. It kind of conjures up images of like people getting onto a steamship with a pair of birds in a cage. Really, though, the biggest releases of sparrows in the United States seem to have been carried out by cities or civic organizations, not people coming to the U.S. with a couple of familiar birds.
And at first, there was a lot of enthusiasm around the idea that the sparrows might save everyone from all those pesky caterpillars. For example, in 1859, William Cullen Bryan wrote a poem called The Old World Sparrow, which began, "We hear the note of a stranger bird that ne'er till now in our land was heard. A winged settler has taken his place with Teutons and men of Celtic race. He has followed their path to our hemisphere. The Old World Sparrow at last is here." the insects legion that sting our fruit and strip the leaves from the growing shoot, a swarming, skulking, ravenous tribe, which Harris and Flint so well describe, but cannot destroy, may quail with fear, for the old world sparrow, their bane, is here.
If you're thinking, something about this poem feels a little racist to me, we're going to get to that later. And not everybody thought this was a great idea, especially as the number of sparrows started to grow and people realized that they were not only not magically ridding North America of unwanted caterpillars, but were also eating grain and other food crops. In April of 1867, Charles Pickering spoke before the Boston Society of Natural History, describing the introduction of the European house sparrow as threatening a great evil. According to the society proceedings, he cited proofs from, quote, standard authors that showed that the bird had been, quote, the acknowledged enemy of mankind for more than 5,000 years.
In 1868, Thomas Mayo Brewer came to the house sparrow's defense in Atlantic Monthly, writing, quote, the sparrow is not all evil. That he does a great deal of good is now universally admitted. The good already accomplished by the few of his race domiciled among us is indisputable and of the first importance. Brewer did acknowledge that there were reports of the birds eating ripening grain, but he ended this piece with, quote, the house sparrow will ere long become one of our most common and familiar favorites.
By 1872, Elliot Cowes was voicing his doubts about the sparrows. On May 28th of that year, he wrote to zoologist and ornithologist J.A. Allen saying, quote, do you share my apprehension about that wretched ornithological bouleversement, Passer domesticus? I despise the sight of that bird in this country. I'm not sure how Allen responded, but at this point, he might not have actually shared Cowes' apprehension yet. 2 years earlier, he had written a piece on the rarer birds of Massachusetts for the American Naturalist. And he had said of the sparrows, quote, the few pairs turned loose in the Boston Common a few years since seem to be slowly increasing in numbers and bid fair to be of great service in checking the ravages of several species of caterpillars that now greatly injure the foliage of the shade trees. These interesting birds are now frequently observable both on the common and in the public garden.
Cowes also voiced his apprehension in his Key to North American Birds, which came out that same year. It described the birds as already abundant in many towns and cities of the eastern and middle states, and also recently introduced into Salt Lake City. Quote, it has proved highly beneficial by destroying cankerworms, the pest of our shade trees, and our dusty streets are enlivened with its presence. But if it continues to multiply at the present rate, it must soon overflow municipal limits, and then the result of the contact of this hardy foreigner with our native birds may cause us to regret its introduction, unless it finds natural enemies to check its increase.
So Cowes and Brewer already had differing opinions on this sparrow, but until this point, their relationship seems to have been pretty cordial. Cowes had referred to Brewer as a friend, but things started to become acrimonious in 1874, and we'll get to that after a sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
Jesus girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
By the early 1870s, it had become clear that house sparrows were not going to save North America from caterpillars. They did eat caterpillars, but in some areas, that inchworm outbreak had ended and a new caterpillar outbreak had started, but these were fuzzy caterpillars that the sparrows apparently did not like to eat. The sparrows also liked to eat grain. That was, of course, a problem with crops, but they also liked to pick partially digested grain out of horse manure, which was all over the streets and cities and towns in the era before the introduction of automobiles. So people obviously thought that was gross and that the birds were unsanitary. House sparrows also like to nest in and near buildings, and they like to congregate in the foliage and sing together, and people found their chirping very annoying.
In July of 1874, Elliot Cowes reported a communication from ornithologist and naturalist Thomas G. Gentry in the zoology section of American Naturalist, saying that European sparrows were driving robins, bluebirds, and native sparrows away from Germantown, Pennsylvania, and that their population was growing rapidly. Cowes added to this, quote, "I did not expect the bad news quite so soon. Probably it will not be long before we hear the same complaints from other places. I have always been opposed to the introduction of the birds, mainly on this score, but also for other reasons. There is no occasion for them in this country. The good they do in destroying certain insects has been overrated. I foresee the time when it will be deemed advisable to take measures to get rid of the birds, or at least to check their increase."
In September, American Naturalist printed a response from Thomas Brewer, who wrote, quote, "I regret very much that a naturalist generally so well informed as Dr. Cowes should aid in giving what my own observations compel me to believe to be an altogether wrong statement in regard to the house sparrow." Brewer described Cowes as biased. I mean, he had admitted he was opposed to the bird's introduction from the beginning. Brewer said now Cowes was condemning the birds based on the scantiest of evidence. Brewer also rejected Gentry's report entirely, and he refuted it point by point, but his refutation mostly involved him saying that he did not believe what Gentry had written, and he had not observed the birds doing those things, and had, in fact, seen the opposite.
Brewer and Cowes also had a similar back and forth in American Sportsman, and in 1877, they rehashed the entire same argument in the Washington Gazette.
By this point, most ornithologists and other scientists generally agreed with Cowes' position on the sparrows, but Brewer still had defenders from other fields. Clergyman Henry Ward Beecher, brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, condemned cows and praised the sparrow in a piece called Sparrows to the Rescue, which was published in the Christian Union in 1877. Beecher wrote of cows, quote, "His name shall be known in the kingdom of birds as a public foe. A price shall be put upon his head, and on some day unawares he shall be surrounded by swarms of sparrows darkening the sun and multitudinous as the locusts of Minnesota." This piece then kind of becomes a reenactment of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, with the birds targeting cows. Cows' other opponents included Henry Berg, founder of the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, who called him a murderer.
In January of 1878, Brewer visited cows at his office in Washington, D.C., where their discussion apparently became heated. Cow said the Nuttall Ornithological Club, of which Brewer was a member, should investigate the impact of the house sparrow. And the club did, but Brewer did not attend the open meeting where the birds were discussed, and the club's other members were critical of the sparrows. A couple of incredibly insulting articles about the club then appeared in the Boston Evening Transcript and the Boston Journal. Cows accused Brewer of writing them. Brewer denied that.
In the August 1878 issue of American Naturalist, there was an article by Elliot Cowes called "The Ineligibility of the European House Sparrow in America." He began, quote, "It is very regrettable that the sparrow question, which has already become a matter of national moment, should have degenerated into such a miserable personal controversy between the sentimentalists who misrepresent the facts and the ornithologists who understand them, that a prudent person, whatever his views, might refrain from having anything to do with it."
After describing it as the conscientious discharge of his duty to lay out all the facts, Cowes continued, quote, "I do not write for ornithologists, for so far as I am aware, there is not a scientific ornithologist in America among those who have expressed any decided opinion who are in favor of the wretched interlopers which we have so thoughtlessly introduced and played with and cuddled like a parcel of hysterical slate pencil eating schoolgirls."
He then went on to insult Brewer specifically, although without naming him. Quote, "I am in position to affirm that the sneers, the invectives, the ridicule and abuse, and the wild assertions of the leader or leaders of the pro-sparrow faction result from a frantic despair in the face of the facts which ornithologists coolly adduce."
With that out of the way, he characterized the sparrow's defenders as, quote, "first, those who know nothing and care nothing particularly about them, except that they rather like the pert and brusque familiarity of the birds, a class composed chiefly of children, women, and old fogies. Secondly, those who are or were instrumental in getting the birds here and are interested, either in reputation or in pocket, to keep them here. Thirdly, quasi-ornithologists who have been misled into hasty expressions of opinion to which they feel bound to stick. Fourthly, the clackers of the last who play a sort of Simon Says Up game. Fifthly, a very few intelligent and scientific persons, but not practical nor professional ornithologists, who recognize fully what little good the sparrow undeniably does and shape a favorable argument mainly from the undisputed advantages which result from a certain just and proper number of sparrows in Europe."
Cowes then offered five arguments against the house sparrow. They don't do the thing they were imported to do, which was eat all the caterpillars. They attack, harass, and sometimes kill native birds. They destroy things like kitchen gardens and grain fields. Quote, "They are personally obnoxious and unpleasant to many persons. And lastly, they have no natural enemies and nothing to check their spread."
There's a great quote from point four, which reads, quote, "I am not a delicate woman, nor yet a squeamish man, to be shocked by their perpetual antics during the spring and summer. Being something of an anatomist, I can stand it without embarrassment. But all are not thus constituted."
He also threw in another dig at Brewer, again without naming him, quote, "Let the authorities of any of our large cities, preferably Boston, where the birds are said to have done so much good, and where the sparrow combination talks loudest, furnish to proper persons, say, 500 sparrows, whose stomachs shall be examined by some competent botanist and entomologist together."
Cows ended the article by recommending that the birds be left to take care of themselves, so people should not feed them, put up birdhouses to protect them, or kill their predators. And he advised that any laws protecting house sparrows should be repealed. That way, if, for example, Boy Scouts wanted to start a sparrow-killing project, nothing would get in their way.
Cows was also insulting Brewer in his personal correspondence. On May 19, 1879, he sent J.A. Allen the following poem. Quote, "There was an old person of Beacon Street, of whom history itself doth repeat, that he stood on his head till the sparrows all said, it is quite an anonymous feat."
That September, Cowes published On the Present Status of Passer Domesticus in America, with special reference to the Western States and Territories. This was sort of an annotated bibliography of the sparrow controversy, including his own publications, Brewer's, and that of several others. Cowes makes his opinions about Brewer very clear, for example, describing an anonymous piece that he attributed to Brewer as, quote, "one of Dr. Brewer's most amusing tirades." And Cowes described his own The Ineligibility of the European House Sparrow in America as, quote, "a general statement of the case, indicting the sparrow with specific charges and recommendations."
Yeah, just to be super clear, that's that piece we just read a bunch of really insulting passages from, where he insulted all kinds of people.
Listen, it's just a general statement of the case.
About 4 months after Cowes published this article, Brewer died. So, unfortunately, we don't have, like, a point-by-point rebuttal from him. He passed away. 3 years after that, Cowes accepted that it was not possible to eradicate the house sparrow in North America, writing that he, quote, "led the sparrow war for 20 years and only surrendered to the inevitable."
Cowes did not stop criticizing Brewer, though. In 1889, the USDA Division of Economic Ornithology and Mammalogy issued its first bulletin, which was a 400-page report on what was then called the English sparrow. Cowes didn't think the bulletin gave him enough credit, which apparently revived his animosity toward Brewer. In 1890, a new edition to his Key to North American Birds was published, which revised the description of the house sparrow to include, quote, "well-informed persons denounced the bird without avail during the years when it might have been abated. But further protest is futile, for the sparrows have it all their own way and can afford to laugh at legislature, like rats, mice, cockroaches, and other parasites of the human race, which we have imported."
In 1897, after becoming editor of an ornithology magazine called The Osprey, Cowes wrote a regular feature called Dr. Cowes's Column, and in one of those he called Brewer, quote, "a narrow-minded, prejudiced, tactless person." When people criticized him as being in poor taste for writing that, he doubled down, saying, quote, "the harm he did was incalculable, and his name deserves to be stigmatized as long as there is a sparrow left in the United States to shriek, Brewer, Brewer, Brewer." Then Cowes died 2 years later.
When Brewer and Cowes were writing about the qualities and behavior of house sparrows, both of them were mostly dealing in anecdotes. Neither of them had much data to back up the actual impact of these birds on North America. It was true that the sparrows didn't eat as many caterpillars as expected, and that they ate grain and other crops, and that they chirped a lot, and that they picked seeds out of manure. It was also true that they attacked and killed nesting birds, including bluebirds. And we know today that they can carry diseases, such as West Nile virus and salmonella. But these same things are also true of other birds, including other birds that are native to North America. And when it comes to predation, so many other animals also prey on nesting birds.
But the response to house sparrows became particularly hostile, and this was connected to how people talked about them. In the 19th century, people were describing house sparrows in much the same way that they were describing human immigrants to the United States. And this was a period of increasing nativism and xenophobia. Both house sparrows and human immigrants were described as dirty and lazy. They made too much noise. They had too many babies. They were going to take over the country, overwhelming the native bird population or the white population that hailed from the so-called right parts of Europe.
This was not just a coincidental use of similar language. It was connected to how people saw these birds. For example, in 1897, Elliot Cowes co-authored a book called Citizen Bird, which was about birds and nature, but also about values like citizenship. It used sparrows as an example of bad citizens, including the passage, quote, "They increased very fast and spread everywhere, quarreling with and driving out the good citizens who belonged to the regular birdland guilds, taking their homes and making themselves nuisances. The wise men protested against bringing these sparrows, but no one heeded their warning until it was too late. Now it is decided that these sparrows are bad citizens and criminals, so they are condemned by everyone."
This use of language was also connected to the eugenics movement. So a while later, in 1930, for example, eugenicist and conservationist C.M. Gatty equated immigration to the United States from Mexico with the, quote, sparrow problem, describing the, quote, songless immigrant as displacing American birds that were, quote, songsters, insect destroyers, weed seed eaters. He continued by saying that the, quote, old type American is similarly being displaced with Mexican slum inhabitants.
As another example, architect Philip Johnson published an article titled, "Are We a Dying People?" in July of 1939, by which point eugenics was falling out of favor in the United States, but had been adopted and expanded by Nazi Germany. This article was about the idea that white people were not having enough babies and that, quote, the United States of America is committing race suicide. It said in part, quote, the course of nature is not predestined. Human will is a part of the biological process. Our will, for example, interferes constantly in the world of lower animals. When English sparrows threaten to drive out our songbirds, we shoot the sparrows rather than letting nature and Darwin take their course. Thus, the songbirds, thanks to our will, become the fittest and survive.
So, of course, language like this is still around today. It still shows up in conversations about immigration, and it still shows up in conversations about all kinds of non-native species, including European starlings, which were intentionally introduced to North America decades after house sparrows were, long after people had decided that the house sparrows were a problem and should not have been introduced. And people still have extremely strong feelings about house sparrows, especially when it comes to their killing other birds or driving them from their nests.
Today, house sparrows are widespread over most of North America and part of South America. But their numbers seem to have declined in recent decades, and they seem to be declining in Europe and Asia as well. The reasons for this are not entirely clear. Some possibilities include disease, pollution, changing climate, and changes in the food that is available to them.
Also, we mentioned earlier in the episode that John James Audubon had named a couple of birds after Brewer. There's been an ongoing discussion about renaming eponymously named birds in the United States. On November 1st, 2023, the American Ornithological Society announced that it was committing to changing all English language bird names within its jurisdiction for birds that are named after people or whose names are otherwise offensive or exclusionary. In the words of the Society's executive director and CEO, Dr. Judith Scarl, quote, there has been historic bias in how birds are named and who might have a bird named in their honor. Exclusionary naming conventions developed in the 1800s, clouded by racism and misogyny, don't work for us today. And the time has come for us to transform this process and redirect the focus to the birds, where it belongs. I don't know if there is a similar movement regarding animals, but there is one at least that I know of, which is the Coos white-tailed deer,
right,
which is named after Elliot Cowes, but most people say it coos. So if you know about these deer and you think we've been saying his name wrong this whole time, the deer are technically also pronounced cows, but nobody really says it that way.
This is how language evolves. Which then brings up a different thing of like, well, it might be named after him, but no one calls it by his actual name. Do we still need to change it?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. And as I said, I have no idea if there's been a similar discussion about the names of non-bird species. I have some listener mail before we finish up today. This is from Shelly, and Shelly wrote, "Dear Holly and Tracy, I just listened to your behind the scenes about the metric system and had to write in. I'm a middle school math and science teacher, and the experiences about math classes both of you shared really resonated with me, both from personal experience and what I learned in grad school about the history of math education in the U.S. Holly, what you shared about the trauma of timed multiplication tests is a really common experience. It's when most people in this country identify as when I stopped liking math. Joe Baller, professor of mathematics education at Stanford, calls us a math-traumatized nation as a result of the emphasis on speed and memorization over understanding for so many years in our education system. I can tell you the day I started liking math, it was the day we used the quadratic equation in high school chemistry because I finally saw both the purpose of math and why it worked the way it did. I also wanted to share this article by Joe Baller and Lang Chen in The Atlantic, Why Kids Should Use Their Fingers in Math Class. Tracy, I hope it helps you feel better about using your fingers for arithmetic. They're one of the best tools for math we as humans have. Thanks for all the great work you do on the podcast. The History of Science episodes are my favorites. Cheers, Shelly." Thank you so much, Shelly, for this email. I had not seen that article, and I was only able to kind of skim it this morning. But man, boy, do I wish there had been some encouragement about, you know, how to use your fingers to learn math better rather than just like being yelled at to stop doing it.
Right. Oh, I remember the policing of it in one of my elementary school math classes during a test where the teacher literally was like, "If I see you using your fingers under the desk, you will fail the test." And it's like,
yeah,
you're just making us all more scared of math.
Right. And I have long suspected that one of the reasons I had trouble with arithmetic is I really liked, like, we would have little bears to count and sort into different colors and things like that. And anything involved, like, counting the bears or counting numbers of things, like adding things when there were objects there representing the things.
Right.
That was fine. But when I needed to move into the abstract of doing it in my head, like, I just was not able to make that bridge very well. So thank you so much for sending that article. If anybody else wants to Google it, again, it's called Why Kids Should Use Their Fingers in Math Class. If you would like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. We're on social media at Missed in History, and you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app and wherever else you like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.